being an early proposal, but I don't think it ever actually got off the ground. But like you say, this technology comes back to repeat itself. Yeah, I mean, that's why it's always nice when people write everything down and you can go back and look where people were looking to get new old ideas, if you will. Okay, on with the next. The rate that technology is able to shrink the size of memory devices and the data that they contain has always personally amazed me. I personally still remember my old Atari 800 that was packed with an unimaginable, at the time, 48,000 bytes of random access memory. Recently, I purchased a micro SD card the size of a pinky fingernail that had more than 10 million times that more storage capacity than my poor Atari 800. By 2020, researchers estimate that the world's digital archives will weigh in at around 44 trillion gigabytes. That's an astounding amount of data that isn't necessarily being stored in the safest of places. Most storage mediums naturally degrade over time, and even the cloud isn't as reliable as companies want us to believe. So, researchers at Harvard University have turned to some unique chemistry they believe could safely archive the world's data for millions of years without requiring any power. There's been considerable research conducted on DNA, Mother Nature's tried-and-true data storage method, as an alternative way to archive everything humanity wants to save. But to date, the practicality and the cost of such methods have kept that approach relegated to laboratories and limited experiments. So instead of directly copying Mother Nature, chemists at Harvard University took inspiration from her and came up with a way to store data using something called oligopeptides. They are molecules made up of amino acids that are considerably smaller and easier to work with than DNA. Good job for that. Writing data is accomplished using a so-called microwell. It's a thin metal plate perforated with 384 tiny holes. These holes are filled with different and unique oligopeptides made up of amino acids of various molecular weight and with the distribution weight based on the same digital binary code that computers rely on. A device called a mass spectrometer can then be used to read the stored data by simply detecting and sorting out the oligopeptides by their masses. Heavier ones sink and the red is absent, while lighter molecules float to the top and are registered as fresh. It's then a case of translating all the detected molecules into tiny snippets of information that they represent. A mixture of 8 oligopeptides can be used to store 1 byte of data, 32 oligopeptides can store 4 bytes, and so on and so on. Quote, think storing the contents of the New York Public Library with a teaspoon of protein, end quote. Brian Cafferty, a Harvard postdoctoral fellow and lead author of the study, said in a statement. But don't tear out your solid-state drives from your laptop yet. The Harvard researchers have only managed to write, store, and retrieve a paltry 400 kilobytes of data so far, including a Richard Feynman lecture and a couple of images. Read and write speeds are also excruciatingly slow compared to modern flash storage. They're about 8 bits per second for writing and 20 bits per second for reading. And retrieval accuracies top out at 99.9%, but they're hoping error correction algorithms could step in to make this new storage method more reliable. Let me drop for a sec. Using molecules to store data could be more of a complement to existing storage technologies rather than a replacement. The limits to the read and write speeds could definitely be improved as the research evolves, but the real advantage to this approach is that oligopeptides can survive for hundreds of thousands of years under the proper conditions, which don't necessarily have to include light, oxygen, water, or temperature-controlled environment. It could potentially be the ultimate time capsule, although a spoonful of molecules doesn't really make for a great TV show when it's eventually unearthed in a thousand years. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, while space agencies simulate an asteroid impact this very week at the 2019 Planetary Defense Conference that we talked about last week, there's a real asteroid they're monitoring that will make a close appearance in just 10 years. 99942 Apophis, what a name, is among the most infamous near-Earth objects. When astronomers at Kitt Peak National Observatory discovered it in 2004, they initially calculated a 2.7% chance that it would hit the Earth and assigned it a level 4 on the Torino scale, the highest assignment for a near-Earth object ever. Though it has since been downgraded and is expected to pose no threat to the planet, it's a real-life version of that simulated asteroid scenario that scientists are currently playing out. When Apophis flies by on April 13, 2029, the 1,100-foot-wide asteroid will come shockingly close, coming within 20,000 miles of the Earth's surface. Now, by comparison, the average distance between the Moon and the Earth is 238,855 miles. This will be a rare opportunity to study an asteroid really up close. You might wonder how scientists go from predicting a 2.7% chance of impact to ruling out danger from such a large asteroid, and whether you should be worried. Single observations and models have error bars. Spread of potential locations, an asteroid will pass. You can see how only a few observations of an object that will come within 20,000 miles of Earth might suggest a potential strike, but the more observations shrink the error bar and the number of potential paths. Let me drop for a second. By now, researchers have made enough observations of Apophis to rule out a strike in 2029, as well as when it passes the planet again in 2036. The odds are harder to calculate for close approaches further down the line, but for the moment, this particular asteroid is not worth worrying over. Instead, scientists will be discussing what value they can glean from the close approach and whether they should send a mission to study the asteroid. But asteroid impacts more generally are a real concern. At the Planetary Defense Conference this week, NASA, FEMA, and other agencies are simulating a situation quite similar to the 2004 Apophis discovery. But they're discussing more than just how best to observe the asteroid. They're also puzzling over what to do if a real threat to Earth becomes imminent. Humanity has a long way to go before feeling confident in our ability to handle impending asteroid strikes. But for now, I guess we should be thankful that the scientists are at least taking potential asteroid strikes seriously. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes.
This is KD2KDG. Do you know if it's one of the candidates for the asteroid redirect mission? Over.
I do not. Paul, do you know?
No, but now that I think about it, if it's just doing a flyby, it might not be, because it's probably going to be pretty difficult to redirect it at the speed it's going. Over.
That might be the redirect mission. The DART mission where you have the two asteroids, you got one bigger one and another one going in orbit around it. It essentially has its own moon, and it's going to send the DART spacecraft out there to actually crash into the moon one and then try to evaluate any change in the direction. But that might be the redirect mission. I'm not sure. Back to you, Laura.
Very good. I got to get into the habit of calling WS2N Paul 1 and KD2KDG Paul 2. Otherwise, we'll collide with our Paul. I would tend to guess that they haven't really thought up any plans because it's so far away, even for NASA, that this is already 2029 that this is going to come by. So I think they're still sitting around having committee meetings and discussing what they should do for this asteroid. So my gut feeling is no, it's not included, but I could be wrong. Okay, on with the next. Every several years, magnetic field observatories record quick little changes to the position or strength of the planet's magnetic field, these so-called geomagnetic jerks. The cause of these shifts has remained a mystery. Improvements to ground-based observatories and more magnetic field measurements from satellites have given scientists some new insight into the planet's magnetic behavior. Though we can't look directly into the Earth's core, these measurements have led scientists build models to help infer what might be going on in there. More recently, scientists realized that suddenly released moving blobs inside the core could explain the geomagnetic jerks. Earth scientists are pretty sure that the planet generates its own magnetic field thanks to the geodynamo heat-generated motion of conductive liquid metal inside the core, combined with the planet's spin. Changes are generally slow, like being on a fancy new train where you barely perceive the forces of speeding up or slowing down. But sometimes, the magnetic field experiences a little jerk where it is unpredictably going from speeding up to slowing down, similarly in the whiplash-inducing jolts you might feel on a rickety old train. Let me drop for a sec. These jerks occur over the course of just a few years and have appeared in 2007, 2011, and 2014, according to observed data. To better understand this, the researchers built a simulation of the Earth in which the outer core is represented as a rotating spherical shell filled with an electrically conductive liquid and the inner core and mantle as solid sandwiching the liquid layer. It's like a spinning jawbreaker with a layer of goo between the center and the outer shell. The model revealed that isolated blobs appear in the liquid, could move upward and around the core, creating waves through the liquid's electrically charged atoms. Once these waves are stopped by the solid mantle, they compress, leading to the temporary disturbances in the magnetic field that cause the geometric jerk. It would take around 25 years from the release of the blob to the observation of these types of jerks. One drop per second. This is a model based on what we know of the Earth's interior, and it's worth taking it with a bit of a grain of salt. Nor is this the only possible explanation for these jerks. Others have suggested they come from torsional or twisting oscillations in the core, though the researchers behind the new paper argue that the torsional oscillations are too weak to generate the signals observed in real life. Still, models are crucial for better understanding how motion deep in our planet manifests here on the surface, and understanding the jerks might help scientists predict them in the future. You might be aware that the magnetic field protects us from the solar rays that would otherwise make this planet unlivable, so it's nice to be able to understand it better. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
H with a question.
Yes, John.
Hasn't there been a steady drift westward of the North Magnetic Pole over the years? Go ahead.
Yes, there has, and matter of fact, we actually did a story on that about 4 or 5 months ago. It wobbles around, and every so often it actually reverses itself. There are magnetite rocks that have magnetic fields going in each other direction over time.
Is there also a corresponding drift of the South Magnetic Pole, I guess being that the two have to stay diagonally opposite each other? Go ahead.
Yes, it's my understanding that it's a symmetrical process. So there's a shift in the South Hemisphere as well. It's kind of an intriguing example of Northern Hemispheric chauvinism that science and papers are more involved discussing the Northern shifts than the Southern ones.
I think that's sort of related to del dot B has to be zero. The divergence of the magnetic field in the enclosed area has got to be zero. I think it's got to keep like a bipolar feel to it. Anyway, thanks for the comment.
Quite welcome. I mean, it's part of Maxwell's lovely set of equations. The diversion of magnetic field is zero. It's all self-contained and symmetrical. But enough about Maxwell's equations. On to the next subject. Researchers at Tel Aviv University managed to successfully print the first ever 3D heart that uses cells and biological materials from the patient himself. The medical breakthrough, which was published recently in Advanced Science, managed to produce an entire heart, complete with cells, blood vessels, ventricles, and chambers. A marked improvement over previous attempts that only printed simple tissues without vessels.
The process of creating the heart started with a biopsy of fatty tissue taken from the patient. The cellular material from the tissues was used as the ink for the print job. That allowed researchers to create complex tissue models, including cardiac patches and eventually an entire heart. It should be noted that the heart isn't a very big one. It's only about the size of a rabbit's heart. But the technology that made it possible could eventually lead to production of a human-sized organ. Now, currently, these parts can only contract, but researchers plan on culturing the 3D-printed hearts and teaching them how to operate like the real deal. Once the process is complete, they hope to be able to attempt to transplant them into animal models. Now, researchers have been working on 3D-printed tissues for some years now with the eventual goal of creating functioning organs for transplant. The scientists involved in the heart project at Tel Aviv University theorized that within 10 years, it's always 10 years, organ printers could be available at hospitals. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, Doke, on with a novel subject, a little bit esoteric research. This past week, scientists announced that they have made an incredible physics observation using a vat of liquid xenon. It's officially the rarest nuclear decay ever directly measured. The average amount of time it would take a half of the xenon atoms in a sample to undergo this particular type of decay is approximately 1.8 times 10 to the 22nd years. Now, that's roughly a trillion times the age of the universe. Well, last Wednesday, researchers working on this xenon 1T experiment announced that they've made a groundbreaking observation of a kind of nuclear decay called 2-neutrino double electron capture. Essentially, a pair of protons in the atom's nucleus each spontaneously absorb one of the atom's electrons at the same time. This results in the release of a pair of neutrinos and X-rays. Physicists have theorized the existence of this nuclear decay since 1955 and are most interested in it because it's a stepping stone towards the more intriguing physics results. Another kind of event, electron capture without neutrinos, that's when the atom's neutrons spontaneously emit electrons and neutrinos, but the neutrinos go missing, annihilating one another into gamma rays, could reveal profound truths about the nature of the mysterious neutrino, the second most abundant particle in the universe. Let me drop for a second. How is it possible to directly measure an event that you seemingly have to wait until long after all the stars burnt out to experience? Well, thankfully, that's not really how half-lives work. The concept of a half-life essentially says that if you have a batch of atoms, the half-life is the amount of time it will take for a half of the atoms to undergo the nuclear decay that you're studying. The more atoms you have, the more likely you are going to see nuclear decay you're searching for. Now, the xenon 1T experiment involved 3,500 kilograms of liquid xenon buried deep underground in a mountain in Italy. Its primary goal is to measure dark matter particles interacting with the atom, something that has not yet been managed to be done. But of the 3,500 kilograms, approximately 2 kilograms of that are a flavor of xenon that can undergo this 2-neutrino double electron capture event, an isotope called xenon 124, because the number of protons and neutrons in its nucleus is 124. Let me drop it for a second. A quick estimate using high school chemistry would say that that's equal to about 10 to the 25th xenon 124 atoms. And if it takes 1.8 times 10 to the 22 years for half of these atoms to decay, then in 1 year a few hundred or so will decay. And indeed, the scientists reported seeing 126 of the 2-neutrino double electron capture events in the vat of liquid xenon. This is the rarest decay ever directly measured, so scientists have seen indirect evidence of other nuclear decays with even longer half-lives. But you can imagine where a physicist might want to go from here. Neutrino-less double beta decay and neutrino-less double electron capture would both have longer half-lives, so seeing a reasonable number of these events, which scientists want to prove that they exist in the real world and not just in theory, on a reasonable time span would require even larger vats of atoms. And indeed, physicists are already working on experiments like this
and hopes to continue beefing up their existing detectors to hunt for these rare decays. Ultimately, scientists need more observing time. Xenon will soon upgrade to something that they're going to call Xenon NT, with even more liquid xenon, which will allow scientists to observe these events even more frequently and to observe neutrino-less events that have even longer half-life. So, the measurements of the Xenon 1T experiment made was of one of the rarest nuclear decays ever observed, but when you're watching a big enough pile of atoms, you got a shot at seeing one in a sextillion events. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, the subject wowed a lot of guys on YouTube. They were waxing poetic on this. It's part of the many experiments that are trying to find dark matter and failing miserably. So at least they're picking up other things. But on to the next subject after this break. A year and a half ago, in the middle of the Antarctic winter, satellite images of the frozen continent revealed something rather wild. A gaping hole in the middle of Antarctica's sea ice that spans thousands of square miles. Scientists were fascinated and puzzled by the feature, which hadn't appeared at this scale since the 1970s. Now a team of researchers think they know what caused it. The ice hole, known as a polynenia, in parlance of sea ice researchers, was likely caused by a powerful cyclone that spun up in Antarctica's Weddell Sea in mid-September 2017, according to a research published just last Wednesday in the Journal of Geophysical Research. Atmospheres. In an age of human-caused climate change, that's a valuable insight because rising temperatures could alter the frequency or intensity of polar cyclones, potentially affecting the occurrence of these polyninias and, in turn, global ocean circulation. When the polynea was first spotted in mid-September, it spanned about 3,700 square miles, more than twice the area of Rhode Island. It would balloon in size over the weeks to come, reaching 31,000 square miles, that's roughly the size of Ireland, by late October before it merged with the open ocean in the Antarctic Sea and retreated with the onset of summer. The hole was, in a word, enormous and prompted a raft of speculation as to what could have caused it. The site of this, directly above an enormous undersea mountain known as the Mord Rise, made it especially intriguing, as similar giant polynyas had been spotted in the same location in satellite imagery from as far back as 1970. Let me drop for a second. Presence of the Mord Rise seamount, which is described as the equivalent of the Himalayas except underwater in a polar ocean, pushes the warm, dense, salty water that typically lingers near the seafloor closer to the ocean surface. If a big storm rolls through, that can cause this warm water to mix with the cooler, fresher water floating atop the Weddell Sea. And once you do that, you've upset the cart and the warm waters at the surface, and it's going to take months to cool enough to freeze over again. Using a combination of satellite observations and climate models, the researchers determined that the polynyas opening coincided with a cyclone, roughly equivalent in strength to a powerful tropical storm forming over the Mord Rise. The researchers think the cyclone's winds pushed the ice outward from its center, creating a hole that would continue to expand over the days to come. The idea that the cyclones can trigger the polyninas raises the possibility that it will crop up more often in the future, with rising temperatures expected to intensify polar cyclone activity. Climate change is also warming up the oceans, potentially making it hard for the polynyas to refreeze once it's been opened. And this is worth exploring because the polynyas' delivery of ocean heat to the surface, followed by the sinking of that water, as it becomes cooler and denser, plays an important role in global ocean circulation. Changes in this polynya could, in other words, ripple outward across Earth's ocean. Everything is connected. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
That sounds, this is KD2KDG. I just wanted to mention that that last story on Xenon I did hear about, but I just didn't have any particular comments. And I'm about to head off for the night, though. So, good night, I guess. This is KD2KDG73.
Okay, very good. 73, Paul, and please come back and join us again. We do this every Sunday night. And on to our last story for the night. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine told a congressional committee recently that President Trump's accelerated timeline to put humans back on the moon is within the space agency's capabilities, and that a revved-up lunar mission will improve the odds of American astronauts reaching Mars by 2033. For that to happen, however, Bridenstine said that Congress will have to provide some extra funding, the exact amount of which NASA is still trying to figure out. Vice President Pence chastised NASA and its partner Boeing for cost overruns and delays getting the Space Launch System rocket developed. NASA now has a tremendous hill to climb given the sudden urgencies imposed by the Trump administration. As part of a lunar mission, for example, NASA needs to build an outpost in orbit around the moon, a project known as the Lunar Gateway. But NASA has yet to award a contract for the project, nor does NASA have the landing craft required to deliver astronauts from the gateway to the lunar surface and back. And as noted on the SLS rocket, required to reach the moon is still in development. At a NASA town hall held recently, Bridenstine said that the space agency would require additional means to make Trump's wish come true, adding that no one could possibly, quote, take this level of commitment seriously unless there were additional means, end quote. These comments foreshadow his appearance recently in front of the Congressional Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, which is currently reviewing NASA's budget request for 2020. Let me drop for a second. Speaking to the committee, Bridenstine provided no specific details in terms of additional means required aside from telling Congress that NASA will be submitting a budget amendment request for the 2020 fiscal year given the new directive. As it stands, NASA is asking for $21 billion. But that was before the accelerated timeline. The amendment should be ready for Congress by April 15th, he told the committee. That NASA hasn't tabled a budget amendment yet is wholly understandable, considering the directive was dropped onto the space agency just a few weeks before the appearance in front of the committee. That said, Bridenstine seemed to be emboldened, not discouraged, by the 2024 deadline. The way he sees it, this is an opportunity for NASA and its partners, and by consequence, the United States as a whole, to develop the technologies and capacities required for living and working in space, he told the committee. Let's drop for a second. Quote, we're not going to leave flags and footprints and then not go back for 50 years, remarked Bridenstine. This time we're going to stay. NASA, he said, will work with its international and commercial partners to go sustainably and explore the resources of the moon. The NASA chief said that the commercial sector has been a tremendous help, providing, for example, the SpaceX Crew Dragon capsule, and could restore the U.S.'s ability to independently launch astronauts into space. In turn, the U.S. will take the technologies learned from the lunar mission and use them for a future mission to Mars, he said. Mars is the horizon goal, he said. The moon is the tool we need to get to Mars. Bridenstine alluded to the beleaguered Apollo 13 mission of 1970, saying the three-day travel time to the moon would serve as a nice cushion should something unexpected happen, whereas the seven-month trip to Mars won't provide such a luxury in terms of an emergency response time. Let me drop for a second. At the same time, Bridenstine said NASA could continue to do the things only the government can do. He assured the committee that NASA is focused like a laser on the James Webb Telescope, a multi-billion-dollar project that could last as long as 30 years. Among NASA's many other objectives, Bridenstine said, the space agency is also looking to develop hypersonic jets capable of exceeding the speed of sound without causing disrupting sonic booms. He envisions aircraft capable of delivering passengers from New York to Los Angeles in just 2 hours. In response to a question posed by Chairwoman Eddie Bernice Johnson about the importance of returning to the moon sooner rather than later, Bridenstine said that it's a matter of making scientific and technological progress. Quote, by moving up the moon landing by 4 years, we can move up the Mars landing, end quote, he said. Mars is the proving ground. We have to be able to utilize the resources of another world, he said, with such as gaining access to frozen water ice. Let me drop for a sec. Bridenstine said he spoke personally with the vice president, assuring him that NASA would be able to meet the accelerated timeline and that the request was within the realm of possibility. Many of the elements required to reach the moon are already in place or in development, he said, but the development of these elements now has to be accelerated. But this acceleration, he said, has to be reflected in the new budget. Among these elements, the SLS, the Orion crew vehicle, and the lunar landing vehicle. The focus is now getting humans to the moon as soon as possible, said Bridenstine. Bridenstine, actually. In response to a question posed by the committee member Frank Lucas about the extra funds required, but not just to get them to the moon, but to live and work on another world. The NASA chief told Lucas that work on the Space Launch System's core stage is proving to be more challenging than anticipated, and the focus is now getting it complete, which will then allow NASA to work on the rocket's upper stage. Budget constraints, said Bridenstine, preventing NASA from working on these components in parallel. Bridenstine, who described the Space Launch System as the backbone of the mission to the moon, said a recent investigation by NASA concluded that no alternatives currently exist to replace the Space Launch System concept, such as borrowing assets from the private sector. Let me drop for a sec.
Roy, with what Bridenstine has been challenged to do, to go back to the moon, naively you would say, okay, building the right hardware to launch enough material and men to get them to the moon and to land them on the moon, that's doable. But to get them to stay there has one huge problem that I haven't heard anybody express a solution to yet, and that is that throughout the 28-day on the moon, you get an extremely high temperature at high noon and extremely cold temperature at midnight. And the hardware to sustain that is almost beyond belief. So unless he addresses that problem, getting to the moon and staying there on the surface strikes me as a bit of a dream. Over to you, Roy, KGRIW.
I would totally agree with you, Dick. You know, we've had this conversation. You've had it with me. You've had it with Paul. You've had it with a lot of people. I think this is pie in the sky. I think even if you go so far as to just limit it to a simple Me Too of Apollo mission, it's going to take some time because we do not have the infrastructure to do it as quickly as they want to do it. So you put that on top of all the other things that are going on. I think this is just a guy trying to keep his job and find a good reason why the government should kick up the budget for 2020. That's what it sounds. It sounds like he's not the most accurate description of reality. It's kind of blue sky optimism taken to the 14th power. Getting back to the story, a number of committee members, including Suzanne Bonamici, Jennifer Gonzalez-Colon, and Troy Balderson, expressed concern that the pending mission to the moon will take money away from other important NASA initiatives, such as observatories, STEM-related educational plans, and scholarships. The committee also is concerned that NASA's ability to track climate change might be compromised by the distraction of going to the moon. Now, Bridenstine responds by saying no other nation on the planet is as fiscally committed to science as the United States, and that NASA, in cooperation with the NOAA, will continue to track the effects of climate change. Canceled or defunded STEM programs, he said, will be offset by other programs, including FIRST Robotics and an engineering contest for high school students. Committee member Ben McAdam expressed concern that the accelerated timeline would come at the risk of astronaut safety. Quote, are we going to compromise safety? Absolutely not, Bridenstine responded. All safety valves are in place. We're not going to take any undue risk. Let me drop for a second. One of the more interesting moments of the nearly three-hour hearing was when committee member Bill Foster, who received his Ph.D. in physics from Harvard University in 1983, accused NASA of failing to move the needle in finding alternative ways of getting cargo and people into space, such as the use of space elevators and electricity-powered mass drivers, because conventional chemical propulsion is expensive. Foster wondered if NASA is spending money to develop transformative technologies, such as fundamental research into carbon nanotubes, a material allegedly strong enough to hold a space elevator in place. Quote, "It depends on the definition you're using for transformative technology," replied Bridenstine, in which Foster responded a factor of 10 in terms of cost improvement. Bridenstine had no answer for the congressman. "Money is not being spent on making space accessible to most Americans," said Foster, who then asked Bridenstine to reconsider how NASA spends its money. The NASA head was supremely confident and nonplussed during the hearing, brushing aside concerns about tight deadlines and yet-to-be-built technologies. His answers were almost always the same. NASA can get the job done, but only if it's properly funded. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2DS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
They're going to have to get the cost down of space travel before they can even think about doing what they plan on doing. You know, there's a basic law of physics. 97% of a rocket that's made today, you know, is going to be used up basically for fuel. It's only that 3% that turns into a payload. You know, if it's that, and that, you know, it's usually something like 2.5%. So the only way to do it is reusability, and SpaceX is working on that, and so is Blue Origin, and they could drive the cost down. That's the only way they're going to do it, because you have to pour money into it. To get to the moon last time in the 60s, if you look at there was a chart I saw not too long ago, where right now we're at the roughly $20 billion area, you would have to make that like three times that amount to be anywhere near where we were in the 1960s when they were pouring money into the program. You know, either you got to do that or you have to bring the cost of getting mass off the ground back to you.
I completely agree with you, Paul, that the problem is our propulsion technology is not cost-effective enough to do the things that these people want, which I guess is why that congressman with the degree from Harvard wanted to talk about space elevators that are dubious or other technology. What we really need is some new, really cheap form of propulsion that we don't have a clue about. But the problem is lots of luck coming up with that. Basically, if you think about it, jet propulsion is based on basic principles that were known and understood all the way back to World War II. There's nothing except a little engineering finesse across the years and making them bigger and bigger and bigger. But it's still chemical reactions. Ultimately, it comes down to something that's fuel and something that's an oxidizing agent and burning it. There's nothing else. If someone figures out something else, then you could re-budget the NASA and go to Alpha Centauri if you want, I guess. But the problem, as I see it, and as you mentioned it, is our propulsion technology limits us a great deal. We can only go so far. We can only go so fast. And human beings aren't particularly well built for space travel, unfortunately. So go figure. Brought up UFO technology. Well, as soon as you go to Area 51 and take apart an alien ship, please feel free to patent it, make a lot of money, and send over the information to NASA.
You never know what's going to happen. The history of science is one of unexpected breakthroughs. Scheduling a breakthrough is a pointless exercise. So there might be some guy sitting around in a lab someplace that has come up with some kind of bizarre thing that amounts to an anti-gravity field. I think the chances are not great, but they are better than zero. So, you know, who knows what the future will lead. But, you know, going into Congress with a budget request at this point with really nothing behind you except blue sky, it strikes me as not the best way of dealing with reality.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
See, NASA has all these other big projects going that's eating up their money. The space station is roughly $4 to $5 billion per year to keep that active. So that's, you know, 25% of their money out the window already. They keep pouring money into the James Webb Space Telescope. That should have been in orbit in 2017, and that would be lucky to get there by 2021. And then they're pouring, you know, another billion dollars every year into that. I remember when it was $8 billion. I think they're up to 10, heading for 11. So overall cost. And then you've got you're building new spacecraft. You're building the new Mars 2020 rover. This stuff is all, before you know it, your $19, $20 billion is gone. They have to double the money, and Congress is not going to do that.
I agree with you. The Congress is not in a spending mood. Unfortunately, for some weird, weird reason, science isn't valued as much the last few years as it once was. So, and even in the general public, I mean, I think if you tell the general public that we want to go back to the moon, most of them will scratch their heads and say, "Didn't we do that already?" You might get a little bit more excitement for Mars, but Mars is multiply exponentially more expensive than the moon will be. So we're going to have an endless budget crunch type of a problem. And that's, to me, why NASA is as much a public relations firm as it is a scientific branch of the government. You have to kind of dangle these weird devices that make no sense to the public to keep them interested, to keep paying for research. Because people don't really understand the value of research, unfortunately. I wish they were better educated in the public schools.
The other way you can do it is with partners, you know, international partners, like you do with the space station. You've had 20 different countries involved with that, usually mostly around 19, but roughly 20 countries. So, you know, if they all chip in, you know, you might be able to get something to get to the moon and eventually to Mars. European Space Agency has built and almost completed the service module for the Orion spacecraft. But, you know, all this stuff gets us to the moon. It gets us around the moon. It doesn't get us down to the moon. There's no lander yet. I know Lockheed has a proposal for their lander. Again, that's going to be expendable. The first stage will stay behind on the moon. These are the problems that they've been dealing with for decades, you know, since the 1970s.
Yeah, ultimately, NASA is a bureaucracy. It takes them a long, long time. You know, who knows how long it takes for them to requisition a paperclip? Who knows how long it took them to requisition that $19 million a toilet that they had for the International Space Station? You can't pull out plans to land and man a base on the moon and expect them to be doing it in a couple of years. It took the better part of a decade for Apollo to be a reality. So, you know, I don't understand. I think people are just doing it for the headlines, and other people
are doing it as a reason to kick the budget up, but I don't think the Congress is dumb enough to fall for something like that. So I don't know how it's going to end. I just hope that they don't move the money around so that the rest of the research becomes unfunded. I don't see that happening, but you never know with bureaucrats. Okay, very good. Coming up to 11 o'clock, so I will sign off soon. Again, want to remind people, if they have any questions or comments or topics or reputations, the email address that's best is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And everything that I talk about, including the website where you can check to see if LIGO has made any discoveries today, will be posted on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, I thank you, Dick, and I thank you, Paul, and I thank everyone who participated, and hopefully you'll all be back here next Sunday, and we'll do it all over again. So I will hand it off to Dick, who will then hand it off to Paul.
I have a physics question for you, if you want to entertain it.
Far away, Joe.
A couple weeks ago, I brought some electronic thermometers. I was testing them all. I want to see the overall accuracy. And the Chinese made, they all read fairly well. That's not really the question. But what I was really interested in was when I tried one particular test. It was kind of interesting. I put two of the thermometers in a cup of water. I put it in my freezer and had the other two thermometer probes in the freezer out of the water. And, of course, within half hour or so, the thermometer probes are out of the water, registered the proper temperature of the freezer, like about minus something I had set for, something like about minus 10 degrees or something like that. The water took almost 24 hours for it to approach the same temperature range as the freezer. It would go down to like freezing and hover at that temperature for quite a while before it started slowly going down. Then after that, it took a few more hours to go down finally to about 10, 12 below zero. Why is that?
That's cool. Let me get this straight. You had two sets of electronic thermometers. One was exposed to air and the other was exposed to water?
I'm actually testing four thermometers because I want to test the look at the temperature. Yeah, two were exposed to air inside the freezer, and two were in a cup of water in the freezer. And a cup of water coming out was like about 60-something degrees out, give or take. And when I first put the thing in, it took a while for that to draw it down to like 32 degrees. It seemed to stay at 30, 31, 30, 29 degrees for a long time before it finally approached at the temperature of the air in the freezer itself, which is about minus 10, 12, 15 degrees, something like that. Why did the water take so long to follow down to not only hit the freezing level, it seemed like it stopped there, but actually it took so much longer for water to actually register a temperature way, way below freezing? Back to you.
Well, my surmise would be that you're dealing with the melting point. When an object changes state from a liquid to a solid, it sucks up energy, and so it'll stop going down during the transition period. Whereas if you just put something out into the air and convection is what's causing it, and there's no phase change going on, that you get a more immediate shift in the temperature.
It's called heat effusion. Let me explain.
Well, I'm curious of why it took almost 24 hours for the temperature of the water to equal the air temperature.
Heat effusion. Each cubic centimeter of water, to change it 1 degree centigrade, requires 1 calorie. So the air cools off very rapidly. Water cools off very slowly because of this 1 degree per a calorie degree per a calorie per centimeter per degree until you hit the freezing point, 32 degrees roughly. When you hit 32 degrees, you suddenly jump not 1 degree, 1 calorie per degree, it's 80 calories per degree. The heat of fusion, to go from the liquid state to the solid state of ice, you have to extract 80 calories per cubic centimeter, per gram. So you, and you're now waiting for the air pressure, the air circulating around the freezer to do that. So that 80-to-1 ratio, right at the freezing point, plus the fact that the extra mass of the water and the free and the rate of the air moving around it, that sort of explains it, Joe. W-E-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-I-W.
Good. Good answer. I didn't know that. I would, that's a pretty good answer. Okay, so it seems like your point, you're telling me once you hit the freezing point, it takes so much energy to bring water down to a freezing point, but a lot more energy afterwards to bring it well below the freezing point and continuing down. Probably why the oceans never freeze really well, very easily, correct?
And WS2N.
Also, water has got another crazy characteristic. At 4 degrees centigrade, water has the maximum density. As you go colder, it expands. As you go warmer, it expands. That's the reason why ice sits on top of the water that it's frozen to. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Joe looks it up. You know, you can find it. Latent heat of fusion, they call it. And I deal with the BTUs, so it's 144 BTUs per pound of water. Dick is on a metric system, but you find that information. If you see 144 BTUs, you're on the right track too when you're looking it up. Also, for going from water to steam, you got 970 BTUs change going from water to steam. So it's even a bigger amount of heat that's required to do that. But, you know, in that time frame, going from water to steam, nothing's happening. It's not changing temperature at all. You know, instead of 144, now it's 970. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, had you put your thermometers in a pot of water on the stove, you'd watch the water get hotter and hotter until it hit 212 Fahrenheit or 100 centigrade, and then it would sit there. As the steam is coming off the water and boiling, it would sit at exactly 100 degrees centigrade, no matter how long you wait until all the water is boiled away. 540 calories per gram is heat of fusion to go from a liquid to a gaseous state. 80 calories per gram to go from the liquid state to the solid state when you make ice. So you have to extract 80 times as much heat from water to go that last degree as you go from non-freezing to freezing of water. That's a crazy characteristic. But what's going on at the molecular level is not easy to explain. Over to you for any further questions on this one, Paul. I mean, Roy. Hi, Joe. W-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-I-W.
No further questions on it. No further questions. I've never really looked this up in any kind of science books or even on Google or something like that, but it's kind of interesting. I will look it up sometime. Interesting phenomena, interesting facts you bring up on the net. You do seem to be a fount of information, don't you?
It was a great experiment that Joe did.
And a great big group of people, lots of information they're trading back and forth. And what's happening at the molecular level to make an antenna radiate its radio signal? Oh boy. Okay, nice science, Roy. Thank you. And now we're going to be hearing about the launch that took place this week. 5,000 pounds got launched to the International Space Station. I think it got delayed because of an electrical problem up there. And so the hardware is being developed for getting to the International Space Station and in the direction of getting to the moon. But landing and staying on the moon, that's another story. WS2N, K2RIW with a space report. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay. Well, NASA solved the problem of supplying the space station with people and with cargo by getting involved with the commercial Industries back in, what, 2012. They really started doing that, actually launching things to the space station. That was the first time SpaceX did that. And here we are in 2019, and that was their 17th cargo mission to the space station by a private company. That's only one of the private companies. There is another one that as well that sends the Cygnus spacecraft up to the space station. But first one I want to talk about was another launch that occurred on Thursday. It's called the New Shepard, and I've talked about this rocket before. It's built by Blue Origin, and this was the 11th test of this vehicle. They've had three different vehicles. You know, this is the third iteration of the New Shepard, and it launched last Thursday morning, and I saw it live. It launched from Van Horn, Texas. That's where their launch test facility is, and they launch these things. They get above the Kármán line, which is 100 kilometers, so they get above that 62-mile height, and then the booster itself comes back and lands vertically. So it's again reusable. So that's why I said before, two companies that are really doing good for reusability is SpaceX and Blue Origin. But this particular flight was interesting. You know, they have their own website, and then because they had some NASA projects on board, there were 38 STEM-related projects that were on this is a suborbital spacecraft that will eventually carry people. But because NASA was involved, it was also on the NASA. You can watch it on the NASA TV. So that made it interesting. Before that, NASA didn't cover it because it had nothing to do with them. I did find a website or the webcast online, and I sent it over to roy.ac2gs on Roy's website. And you can click on that. And it's the whole thing is like 40 minutes long. And the beginning of it starts off with their promotion from Blue Origin, which is like a commercial, but they show what they're doing or what they've done, you know, with a quick little video. Then after that, they give you a lot of information and examples of what they are doing. But then the live broadcast comes on that they were doing that Thursday morning, and they talk about windows, the gigantic windows in the crew capsule. They're eventually going to put six people in this. Probably by the end of the year, they'll probably put two in to test it. But right now, it looks like maybe by next year they'll actually be able to put paying passengers on board for suborbital flights. And they showed a launch. They use it's only one engine, a BE-3 engine. It runs on liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. They show different information. They show the seats. The seats are there. The windows are there. Then they, right before the launch, you can see the vanes on the bottom moving. You can see the rocket engine gimbling, testing that out. And then they launch. They go about 3 Gs, which is about the same speed the space shuttle was going when that would go up with a crew on board. They show MECO, which is main engine cutoff. They show the separation between the booster and the crew capsule. They show the drag brakes come on at near the top of the vehicle. They open up, and that catches the wind on the way down. The BE-3 engine lights right when it gets near the landing pad. You can see it hovering over the ground, and then eventually the booster lands. At the same time, the capsule is still flying. theoretically with the crew on board. Eventually the drogue chutes come out, three big chutes come out, and eventually the old capsule comes down around 15 miles an hour by the time it lands, and then it has these retro rockets that fire at the last second to soften the blow as they hit the ground at 3 miles per hour. So,